time for the Outspoken Cyclist, your weekly conversation about bicycles, cycling, and related topics. The Outspoken Cyclist is produced for broadcast and podcast, with a new show available every Saturday at 6 p.m. In Northeast Ohio, you can hear it on WJCU 88.7 FM. Catch our podcast after the close of the on-air show at OutspokenCyclist.com, iTunes, Stitcher, or PRX, the Public Radio Exchange. Now here's your host, Diane Jenks.
Hello, welcome to The Outspoken Cyclist. I'm your host, Diane Jenks, and this is our show for April 20th, 2019. Happy Passover! Happy Easter! Happy April weekend! This week, I'm bringing you two encore presentations, both of which hold special places in my heart. The first is with the woman who walks the walk, talks the talk, and makes a huge difference in the world. Shannon Galpin was National Geographic's 2013 Adventurer of the Year, and she pretty much single-handedly brought about the Afghan women's cycling team, which was nominated for a Nobel Peace Prize a few years ago. Shannon is an activist, co-founder of the wildlife conservation organization Endangered Activism, a two-time survivor of a traumatic brain injury, and a great example to her daughter, taking the youngster out of school, traveling the world, and bringing endangered species activism to life through art. Over the past couple of weeks, there's been a lot of angst and upset among many women in the cycling world as they struggle with racism, sexism, and gender issues. There are so many examples of great role models for these young women to follow, and I would put Shannon at the top of that list. My conversation with Shannon Galpin is from April of 2016. Then is my encore conversation I had back in May of 2014 with the now lost voice of the Tour de France, Paul Sherwin. When we spoke, Paul was at his home in Uganda and was filled with ideas of how to bring a rich and strong cycling culture to Africa. He was a seven-time Tour de France rider himself, as well as a two-time British cycling champion. It was a huge blow to the cycling world when Paul died at his home in Uganda last December. He was only 62. So before we visit these two great conversations, there are a couple of short items I'd like to relay. One is comical, although those affected probably don't think so. One is terrifying and infuriating. And the third is, because of the subject, bringing up some history and a need for more understanding of what happens sometimes as fame fades. So the first item I came across that I thought was funny, although it probably isn't so funny to the people who filed lawsuits about it, it's one titled, "Vigilantes Are Taking Scooters Off the Streets of San Diego and Bird and Lime Are Pissed." Now, the thing that's really funny is the picture of the guy dressed up in a Spider-Man costume riding one of these bird scooters. However, it goes on to say, a company in San Diego co-founded by a former Marine has been scooping up the abandoned scooters that litter city streets owned by the startups Bird and Lime for months, giving some of them back to Bird in November in exchange for more than $40,000. Bird and Lime have since called the company's activities ransom, and a legal battle has begun. Both scooter rental startups sued the company, known as Scooter Removal, and its founders last month, arguing that the company's removal of scooters was in many cases illegal. Yeah, it seems to me it would be illegal to just steal them. I don't know how just many cases would be illegal. I think all of them would be illegal, but I don't know. The civil complaints, both filed in California Superior Court in San Diego, Lime's on March 19th and Bird's a day later, make for good reading and describe a pattern of scooter confiscations that the company say started last summer. So here's where I think it gets really, really interesting. And that is that the people who founded Scooter Removal somehow are involved in a bicycle rental business. So I'm not sure where this is going to go, but I think it will be fun to follow the story. You can find it at Jalopnik, JALOPNIK.com. If you're interested, it's by Eric Schilling. It appeared this week on Wednesday, the 17th. Again, vigilantes are taking scooters off the streets of San Diego and Bird and Lime are pissed. Just thought it was a really interesting story. Okay. The second story is truly terrifying. It was written for Bicycling Magazine by Robert Annis on April 17th, and the title is What Kind of Maniac Would Do This? Cord strung across bike trail severely injures 69-year-old rider. Nard Klar loves to ride his bike. The 69-year-old Colorado artist rides every chance he can get, often going on long-distance touring trips with friends. That's why what happened on March 28th hurts twice as much. Klar was taking advantage of a sunny Thursday morning to ride the Rock Island Trail, a paved bike trail in Colorado Springs, with his friend Zach Chapman. The pair reached the trail's end and turned around. The way ahead was long and straight with a slight downhill. Traffic was light, so Klar picked up a little speed. But in the 10 minutes that passed on the pair's out-and-back route, someone had strung a taut parachute cord across the bridge on the trail. It blended in so well with the scenery that Klar didn't see the cord before striking it at somewhere between 15 and 18 miles an hour. The trap caught his cantilever brake cable, locking up his front wheel. His Black Mountain Cycles Monster Cross bike flipped, sending him crashing hard to the pavement and shattering his helmet. Chapman crashed as well, though not as severely, and when he recovered, he saw Klar breathing irregularly and convulsing and immediately called 911. Klar doesn't remember anything between the moment of the crash and when he woke up in the hospital, his torn and bloody cycling kit tossed in a trash bin in the corner. He suffered a broken right clavicle, 3 broken ribs, a severely sprained left thumb, a concussion, and a bad case of road rash. He may need surgery to repair his clavicle. It goes on to tell us a little more about Klar's incident, but the article goes on to say that Klar's crash came a few days after a San Diego cyclist reported narrowly avoiding barbed wire strung neck high across another trail. Last fall, 3 men in Portland, Oregon were arrested for stringing twine across a popular bike and pedestrian path, causing injuries to a rider's face and neck. While there's no database tracking these incidents, traps set on bike trails are a rare but persistent menace. South Carolina attorney Peter Wilborn said that while traps account for a statistically small number of cycling cases, nearly every lawyer in his bike law network has experience with them. Bike booby traps have been around for 30 years or more, Tim Blumenthal, president of People for Bikes, told Bicycling after the Portland case. He added that the most common tactics involve sprinkling tacks or burying wood strips with nails pointing up along the trail. It isn't funny, and it isn't a prank, and it does carry with it criminal assault charges. Colorado Springs police are investigating Klar's case as a criminal assault, though they haven't yet identified any suspects. They're asking that anyone with tips can call the 719-444-7000 number. Klar, meanwhile, says he wants to keep looking forward, doesn't want to dwell too much on his assailants. My last item is sad in many ways, but there is one light at the end of the tunnel. For those of you who remember back in the 80s and 90s, a cyclist by the name of Rebecca Twigg, she's been off the radar for quite some time. There have been many reports of what's been going on with her, and this week in the Seattle Times, under the heading Project Homeless, an article came out by a guy named Scott Greenstone. The article is titled, What an Olympic Medalist, Homeless in Seattle, Wants You to Know. He had the opportunity to sit down and talk with Rebecca, which is something that many people have been trying to do for quite some time. Here's a little bit of what she had to say to him. When Rebecca Twigg was 7, she rode a bike for the first time. There were no training wheels, but Twigg took off like she'd done it in a previous life. She fell only when she realized she didn't know how to stop and steered into a wall. I took to the road like I was born to do it, Twigg says today, except for the little part about stopping. I'm not a very good planner. The Seattle-raised athlete went on to become one of the most famous American cyclists in the 80s and 90s, winning 6 world championships and medaling in 2 Olympics. She appeared on cycling magazine covers, in sponsor ads, and in features in Sports Illustrated and Vanity Fair. But in 1996, she left the team abruptly during the Olympics and the next year retired from cycling. She re-entered the workforce, but it didn't work out. She said, once you've done something that feels like you're born to do it, it's hard to find anything that's that good of a fit. Rebecca Twigg has now been without a home for almost 5 years in Seattle, living first with friends and family, then in her car, then in homeless shelters, and then for a night under garbage bags on the street downtown. She hasn't had a bike for years, and no one recognizes her anymore, she says. Twigg, 56, agreed to share her story to convince the public that not all homeless people are addicted to drugs or alcohol, that there are many like her who have struggled with employment and are confused, as she said she is, about what to do next with their lives. She did not want to discuss mental health, but feels it should be treated more seriously in Washington. Some of the hard days are really painful when you're training for racing, Twigg said, but being homeless when you have little hope or knowledge of where the finish line is going to be is just as hard. In March, as her 56th birthday approached, she got the flu and had to go to the hospital. From there, she persuaded a relative to take her in again so she could convalesce. From her own experience, Twigg thinks the answer is building more affordable housing. Shelters are great, but there has to be a next step, Twigg said. She still won't accept housing for herself, even when help is offered by people who found out about her state. The point is not so much that I need help. It's that there are a bunch of people who need help. 12,000 in this area, 500,000 in the country, Twigg said. Help should be provided for everybody, not just a few, even if they are Olympians. So I'd like to make you aware of some things that are being done for Rebecca. We will be talking with Inga Thompson next week, who is also one of those fabulous women from cycling. And she has set up a new foundation, including a page dedicated to Rebecca. If you are interested in knowing more, you can read this article in the Seattle Times under Project Homeless from April 15th, written by Scott Greenstone. We'll take a quick break for a station ID, and then we'll be back for my encore conversation with Shannon Galpin. You're listening to The Outspoken Cyclist.
You're listening to the station that is your home for college radio in Cleveland, 88.7 FM, WJCU, University Heights.
We are back. Here is my conversation with Shannon Galpin, previously recorded for our April 30th, 2016 podcast.
The New York Times deemed it important and necessary to report on women's sport in Afghanistan. I'm sure many of you read the article. It's been all over Facebook and the internet. They talked especially about cycling. And the article titled Afghan Women Eager to Play and Relegated to the Sidelines, which is written by Rod Norland, talks about cricket and taekwondo, but states that, quote, while all women's sports here are suffering, none have failed quite as spectacularly as the women's national cycling team. Celebrated in documentaries and the subject of a 2014 book and a blizzard of news articles, the team was recently nominated for this year's Nobel Peace Prize, thanks to the tireless promotion of its benefactor, Shannon Galpin, who financed the team through her Colorado-based charity, Mountain to Mountain. The article also talks about the U.S. financial support of women's sports in Afghanistan, but now all that has changed. We are going to talk with her this evening about her recent decision to withdraw her support of the Afghan Cycling Federation because of what she described as, quote, out of control, unquote, corruption by the team's longtime coach and the head of the federation, Haji Abdul Siddiq Siddiqui. Shannon, who will be returning to Afghanistan for the first time in a while, is our first guest this evening. We'll see what she has to say about the future and fate of the women she is so earnestly wanting to help. So we welcome Shannon Galpin back to The Outspoken Cyclist. Shannon, thanks for joining me on the show this evening.
I'm thrilled to be back on. Thank you.
Oh, you're welcome. You're having the time of your life, I know, right now.
Oh, yeah. It's a little insane right now, for sure.
How are you feeling personally right now? I know that you went through some stuff with a brain bleed last year and you weren't allowed to fly and you had to stay kind of put. How's that going?
That actually is going really well. Thanks for asking. Yeah, I had this 3-centimeter clot in my brain after my last trip to Afghanistan. No idea why, but the recovery was much slower than someone like me, and probably anybody, to be fair, really is comfortable dealing with, because I couldn't ride a bike, I couldn't go running, I couldn't surf, I couldn't climb, I couldn't really go to yoga even. And so, you know, what do you do? So I had a lot of self-reflection, and I learned to meditate, and had, you know, really thought about, what am I doing with my life?
Well, didn't you get a new puppy too?
I did get a new puppy. Not great brain recovery material. I would never recommend getting a puppy when you have a brain injury.
No,
I think that's
probably
why I got
not.
A puppy, was because I had a brain injury.
Right, exactly. But the puppy's so cute.
So cute.
Yeah. Yeah. So I guess we need to get serious, although brain injury is serious, and I'm glad you're feeling better. And I know you're heading back to Afghanistan finally. This week, the New York Times published an article about women in sport in Afghanistan, citing the growing violence against women as well as rampant corruption. And it's all but collapsed your cycling programs over there. And then you commented to me personally that none of this is new, and that your hope wasn't just for the sport, but for cycling somehow normalizing women in the social structure. So tell us what's going on, what you would hope for, and what actually happened.
Well, you know, I've tried to make it very clear that I was thrilled that the New York Times article came out. I spoke with the journalist, and to me, the best thing that could happen for women's sports in general in Afghanistan, and particularly for cycling, since that was the focus of the story, is that the corruption, mismanagement, and abuse is front and center. Like all of these, you know, quote-unquote scandals, it takes a lot of voices speaking up and insisting upon change. Otherwise, nothing, you know, the status quo is never going to change without getting challenged. And when I was back in Afghanistan last July, I finally had a lot of the proof of things that I had been looking for about allegations against Coach, selling bikes that we had donated from Liv, selling some of the equipment, and then just pocketing the cash, misusing funds that I was providing for racing and stipends. But it's really hard when it's just your word as a foreigner, especially against, you know, the Federation. And so finally I confronted him. We had a huge blowout fight in July, and I came home and a week later ended up in the ICU with a brain injury.
So interesting.
That kind of quieted down a little bit. But in February, I had funded the team to go to the South Asian Championships in India. Coach took the girls to India, but he didn't take them to the race. He took them to go visit family and to take his new wife to the doctor, and the girls never got a chance to race or represent their country. So I finally basically blew up, told the Cycling Federation as that institutional structure that we're out. I'm not supporting this anymore, and this needs to change. And they denied any wrongdoing, any corruption, of course.
Of course.
Of course. So in the meantime, though, for me, it was really looking at, how do we support these girls? How do we support the team? I already have three or four other groups of girls that are riding in Afghanistan that are not part of the team. So the movement is going forward. You know, the inspiration of the national team is still inspiring other girls to ride. There are clubs and another team that has formed in another province. So that, you know, the program is not collapsed. The program is still going forward. But the Cycling Federation underneath the Olympic Committee, the corruption and the mismanagement of that is falling apart for all the women's federations.
Wow. It's just mind-boggling to me that all these bikes have disappeared, all this money has disappeared. This guy who was such a supporter, it seemed, of the women's cycling team is just like turned out to be kind of, you know, not a nice guy.
Kind of getting what he can out of it, which is, you know, it's one of the most corrupt countries in the world. It's systemic, and it's not surprising. And I've been aware of that, having worked in the country for 8 years, that this is always an issue. And one thing that I'd like to make clear is the great thing is most of the bikes have been recovered. I did a sneak attack recovery to some of the bikes in Bamiyan last year. And we literally stole them back. My boyfriend actually was with me and documented the whole thing, which was hilarious. And then I have kind of a couple of moles of some of the male cyclists that, you know, really butt heads with the coach and have now fired him from the men's team. And they feed me a lot of great information when they hear that coach is trying to sell bikes or coach is trying to, you know, do something. I can kind of head it off at the pass and let him know that, you know, I may be enough in America, but I am very much aware of what you're doing. And, you know, when I come back, there will be a reckoning.
Well, and so you are getting some support on the Afghani side.
Yes. And the hope with this upcoming trip is to build more support with the current president of the Afghan Olympic Committee, as well as some people very poised to help within the Afghan government that could potentially just apply pressure and just say, look, you know, we're aware of what's happening. This is, you know, this is a travesty. When you look at it, it's not just one federation. You know, it's also the soccer federation, the cricket federation, it's the taekwondo team. And in all cases, this thing, this activity of sport, which is so empowering to women, and cycling especially, which, you know, these girls are breaking this taboo, and it gives not only them the chance to compete as athletes, but it's giving them the ability to have independent mobility by knowing how to ride a bike. This is the ultimate story of hope and empowerment, and yet it's still constrained within the same institutions of oppression that exist everywhere else in the country.
Let me remind our listeners, we're speaking with Shannon Galpin. Shannon actually has a nonprofit called Mountain to Mountain. She's written a book, and she is one of National Geographic's Adventures of the Year. Nothing to sneeze at here. You are going back. When are you leaving?
So I'm going back next week for a very fast turnaround trip, but it's really geared at what the next steps are.
And what are the next steps?
So the hope is to bring the team out of Afghanistan. And we have a couple of different scenarios, and really it's limited by visas. Can they get visas to the U.S.? And with Afghanistan and Syria and other countries having this massive refugee crisis, it means that it's very difficult to get visas because they're viewed as a flight risk.
Right.
And so what we're trying to do is work with the embassy to allow a one-month provisional visa to get them here for a one-month training camp in Colorado, real coaching, real training, and start to work with leadership skills so that they could start to run the team in the future. The long-term goal is to set up an all-Afghan women's team that would be based in Colorado, and that would start to prepare not only to train the girls that are interested, there's two girls that are interested to become coaches, but also to train the two or three girls that we think could be potential Olympic competitors for 2020 if they had coaching. And for the others to just simply get the exposure of riding and racing and then taking that back to help nurture the next generation of girls that's coming forward. And so really looking at instilling in the girls the tools to not only represent their country in races, to become better athletes, but also to become the coaches and the next generation of leadership.
So how many girls do you want to bring back?
Ideally, there's eight. That we're pushing for. And two of the girls are not on the national team. They're actually in a different province, but they have set up a women's cycling team there in Bamiyan. And they have been riding and teaching girls to ride for a couple of years simply as a social justice vehicle, that they believe they have the same rights to ride as the boys do. And they started teaching other girls to ride. And it was actually the first province where we saw women's bike racing in Afghanistan. They did right to ride events, and they did a bike race this past year. It's a pretty liberal province. It's pretty safe as well. And so I'd love to get those two girls over as well, so that what we're teaching the girls in Kabul, they can go back and teach in Bamiyan.
Wow. What? I just can't believe you keep doing this stuff. I think it's awesome. I think it's really,
you
really
and
awesome.
Everyone else.
It's just unbelievable.
Yeah, a girlfriend of mine looked at me over coffee the other day, and she goes, you know, you're just relentless.
Which is it's what it takes, evidently.
Yeah, it's rolling with the punches. And don't get me wrong. I mean, I would say, you know, once a day, but usually once a week or once a month, you know, there's that feeling of like, all right, I'm out. I cannot do this anymore.
Sure.
And then the next day you wake up and you're like, well, of course I can.
Of course.
You know,
right.
What else am I going to do? This is what I do.
Exactly. Exactly.
So, yeah. So until the fat lady sings, we're still going.
Okay, that's good. So I want to ask you a question about one of the things in the New York Times article, and that is the support that the U.S. was giving to sports in Afghanistan and what happened there.
Yeah, most of that support, I believe, came through USAID, funding. But in particular, the New York Times article talked about the cricket team, which was recently folded, and then they tried to pretend that the women's cricket team was just practicing in private, even though there actually was no women's cricket team anymore. There's been a lot of abuse. I mean, of funding, and that's been systemic throughout the last 10 years, because so much money has been dropped by the international community, and in particular the U.S. on development projects, but there's not a lot of oversight. And there's a lot of red tape, but there's not a lot of oversight. And from my perspective, a big reason that is because the people who work in the embassies are not allowed to leave the embassies.
Nice.
You know, they don't know what's going on. I do.
Right.
So, you know, I will go and, you know, I travel freely. I don't, you know, all these things that allow me to understand the culture, understand the infrastructure, you know, the barriers, as well as where the back doors and the loopholes that we can use to our advantage. All of that is because I'm there with Afghans. And that means that, you know, I know when 5 bikes are stolen, and I then put pressure on and I return to face-to-face confront that, hey, 5 bikes were sold or stolen, or, you know, I literally march into, you know, a guest house in Bamiyan that has housed the bikes that were stolen, and I steal them back. So that starts to build up the trust that they can't, you know, this isn't a foreign donation half the world away that has no oversight.
Wow, you are brave, Shannon Galpin. You are just... brave.
Persistent to a fault, I think, is what the problem is.
Well, persistence and bravery seem to go hand in hand. So the last thing I want to talk about is this. Oh, and you are welcome. No, we should be thanking you. The cycling team was actually nominated for a Nobel Prize.
Yeah.
What do you think about that?
Oh, it's the Italian group that nominated them reached out to me this fall, and I happened to be in Lesbos at the time, because a male member of the men's cycling team, who was a dear friend of mine, had taken to the refugee trail, and he was crossing from boat from Turkey to Greece, and I flew to Greece to meet him and help him. And while I was there, I was contacted by this Italian group that was nominating the bike itself for the Nobel Peace Prize because of its century plus time of being a vehicle for social change. And you can't nominate an inanimate object for the Nobel Peace Prize. So they wanted to attach the women's national cycling team to that nomination as a modern day example of what the bike is capable of doing and what the bike really means, that it's not just a bike. It's not just a sport. It's also actually freedom in its most literal sense. And so I was thrilled because it does legitimize the girls within their own country, them being nominated for the Nobel Peace Prize in Afghanistan press and media legitimizes them, which then legitimizes the act of riding a bike. At the end of the day, you know, it's a nomination. And if you get enough, if you have the petition and you nominate, you know, then it's up to the Norwegians and the Nobel Peace Prize committee to decide what's legit, which obviously, you know, we put our trust in them. I think it's a beautiful thing, and
I think it
definitely is a way to highlight the bravery of these girls, and also to, like I said, legitimize what they're doing.
So my last question, and I think it's fabulous. We reported on it the moment we heard it. So the last thing I want to ask you is, what can we, the listeners, the cycling community, the people here who hear this program and hear what you're saying, do to help? Are there things we can do?
Yeah, and I think some of it is, you know, on a kind of esoteric level, I think a lot of it is understand that corruption and abuse of power is systemic, not just in Afghanistan, but also here in the U.S. You know, there was a great article that came out in Outside Magazine last year about the professional swim coaching problem. You know, coaches sexually abusing female swimmers, and then instead of having that discussed and any prosecutions, they were just moved to a different swim club, much
really?
Like the Catholic Church.
Oh my gosh.
Yeah, and that's happening, you know, in every country. You have mismanagement and you have corruption. FIFA, UCI, the IOC, the biggest institutions in sport all have corruption cases. And I think that with this particular case, it's really important to realize that we need to have these conversations and we need to not give up on the girls because the institution in which they have to operate as a team is corrupt. That is one more barrier for them. So we need to do more to support them, to help them get past those barriers, and to look at how we can deal with, the lack of women's leadership in sports, here as well. We're going to be doing a massive fundraising campaign because we want to pull the girls out of Afghanistan for this 1 month training camp. We're looking at whether that's in the U.S. or whether that is in a closer venue like the UAE or Qatar, in which they could safely train and where we could bring in the coaching staff, will be dependent upon visas. But we're not giving up on the girls. We're still fighting the fight for them. And they have potentially more opportunity because of this story emerging, because we can push for changes in leadership.
Okay, so people can check in on your site, Mountain yep. 2 Mountain, and there's a 2 in the middle. And, of course, we can watch the national news because that seems to come up more often than not, which is wonderful. I wish you a lot of luck. Please stay safe.
Thank you.
Stay healthy. And we'll check in with
best.
You when you come back from Afghanistan this time.
That sounds fantastic. I'm grateful to keep telling the story and to hopefully build more support for these incredible women.
Thank you. And thank you for the work you do.
Thank you.
All right. Talk to you soon.
Okay. Bye-bye.
Bye. Shannon Galpin is still out there doing great things. If you are interested in her work, you can find her on Facebook. So we're going to take another real quick break, and then we'll be back for my 2014 encore presentation with Paul Sherwin. You're listening to The Outspoken Cyclist. We are back. I'm Diane Jenks. You're listening to The Outspoken Cyclist. His voice will be sorely missed at the tour this year, and we are so lucky to have a great library of his wit and wisdom from past races. Please enjoy this encore presentation of my 2014 chat with Paul Sherwin. We're heading over to Uganda, where it's a little bit later in the day, and I did have to do this earlier just to make sure everything went well. We did this interview by Skype. We're going to talk with Paul Sherwin. Paul, thanks for joining me on the show this evening.
It's a pleasure to speak to the United States all the way from the heart of Africa.
Really? How's Africa today? You said dark when we talked.
Well, it's just coming up to 7 o'clock here in the middle of Africa. It goes dark. In fact, I live right on the equator, so it goes dark within the same 15 minutes the whole year round.
That's interesting. So that means your temperature's fairly temperate also, about the same year round, yes?
That's right, yeah. The only thing, we have four seasons, two rainy seasons, the short rains and the long rains, and two hot seasons. And the temperature is about the same all the time. We don't have any air conditioning in the house, and we don't have any heating.
So what season is it right now?
We're just about coming to the end of the long rains, which have actually extended a little bit. They normally finish around the end of April, but they've been a bit longer this year.
Yes, climate change.
Absolutely.
Absolutely. Well, I think we'll talk about cycling a little bit. What do you say?
Sounds like a good idea.
I guess that's what the people want to hear. That's what they tell me anyway. So most of the people who are listening to our show know you as one of the voices of the Tour de France and many other big cycling races. But you actually go back pretty far historically as a cyclist and a team manager. Tell us a little bit about your history.
Yeah, well, basically my history started in Africa before I went to the UK to go to school and university. And when I got to university, that's when I started cycling to get away from swimming, which I found boring. Swimming up and down the Black Line was not a lot of fun. So I started cycling to get out into the countryside and try and find the wide open spaces that I had growing up in Africa. And that's when I got to university. I got a coach and did quite well and represented Great Britain. Once I finished university, I thought, well, you know, nowadays kids have a gap year before they go to university. Well, I finished university and decided I would have my gap year afterwards. Went and raced in France for 6 months and got myself a pro contract.
And what was that team?
That was a team called Fiat. The amateur team was the ACBB, the Athletic Club Boulogne-Billancourt, which is a big omnisports club in the middle of Paris, which still exists today. And then my first professional team was the Fiat team, which was run by Raphael Geminiani.
So that was Italian team?
Well, it was an Italian sponsor, but it was actually Fiat from France who sponsored it. And Raphael Geminiani was a Frenchman with a very Italian-sounding name.
I guess. Who would have thought? And so how long were you with that team?
I was with that team for 2 years. And then I joined a team called La Redoute, which was based in the north of France. In fact, the head office of La Redoute is in Roubaix, and that's a name that you might have heard of because it's at the end of quite a well-known bicycle race, which takes place over one day. Yeah, and that was, I rode for them for 6 years, then I raced for Rally for 2 years. And once I retired from Rally, I managed the team for a couple of seasons.
And then, so how did you transition from racing and team management into the cycling analysis type work that you do now?
I think I would blame that on Phil Liggett.
We can blame a lot on him, can't we?
I blame most things on Phil Liggett. No, as I was about to retire from racing in Europe, Channel 4 in the UK were about to start a lot bigger coverage. That was back in 1986. So, in fact, the last 2 years that I raced, I actually started commentating for the Channel 4 Tour de France program in the UK. And I continued even through the team management years. And even when I went on to become a public relations officer at Motorola, I continued doing my television work. So I started all the way back in 1986.
Wow, that's a long time.
Well, I can't remember that far back, actually. I have to take notes.
That's like 28 years.
It's my 28th or 29th year of commentating with Phil Liggett this year, and my 36th year at the Tour de France.
Wow, that's a long history.
Your response to that is, Paul, you don't seem so old.
Oh, Paul, you just don't seem like you could possibly be that old. Now, Phil, on the other hand, of course.
That was good. Now, in television, what they'd say was, that was really good, but could you say it again with a little bit more emotion?
Well, I don't do television, see. I have a face for radio. There you go.
Whoa.
So you and Phil do seem to have a lot of information at your fingertips. I watch, I listen, and I'm always amazed at how much you know about all the teams, all the riders, all of the stages, everything. What kinds of technologies are you using? How do you keep up with all that rider information besides having it all in your brain?
Well, I mean, even today, I'm sitting in Africa, right on the edge of Lake Victoria, which is a lake twice the size of Holland at 26,000 square miles. And I was actually with the power of the internet nowadays, I was watching the stage of the Giro d'Italia. So nowadays, it's much easier to keep in contact with what's going on. And Phil and I keep our own database. There's a lot of databases out around, you know, on the internet now, and there's some very, very good ones, but we actually keep our own personal ones, keeping up to date with all the riders, what they've done, you know, what their wives' names are, what their kids' names are, you know, when they were born, how many wins they had up until last year, how many wins they've got. And then on the other side of it, you know, there's a lot of history, and I spend a lot of, I'm interested in history. I'm interested in stories. I'm interested in geology. So I try and, when we go to an event, I try and find out, each stage, I try and find out some tidbits about the stage, because funnily enough, the cyclists know more than we do about cycling anyway. So I'm actually, when I think about the commentating, I'm actually commentating to your mum or your uncle or your auntie who knows nothing at all about cycling. And they get pulled in by the other things that make cycling interesting, because cycling is not just a stadium. You know, it's not a basketball arena, or it's not a football stadium. It's actually the countryside, and the countryside changes every day and changes with every event. So there's a lot more you can wind into your storytelling.
And it's all interesting. I'm always amazed at the kinds of things I learn by listening to you. So think back to some of your more memorable races that you've been covering. Tell us one or two of your favorites. Do you have a couple?
Every race is different. And every Tour de France is different. I mean, I love the one-day classics. I love Paris-Roubaix and the Tour of Flanders. They stand out to me. If I take all the one-day classics, Paris-Roubaix and the Tour of Flanders stand out so much more to me, because those were two races that I used to get very, very motivated for myself. Those are races from a different era. Those are, you know, wars of attrition. Everybody's going to have bad luck. And you have to fight back from that in those races if you want to be up there. And at the end of the day, even with the television coverage, you cannot, because it's happening live, you don't know half of the stories that are going on. You only even find out a lot of the stories the next day and you know, the week after or 2 weeks after, because there is so much goes on in a race like that, of guys who've fallen into a bed of nettles or crashed into a barbed wire fence and got up and fought back from 3 minutes down to get back into the group they were with. So, you know, those two races are always very, very motivating for me. The Tour, everybody asks about the Tour. You know, every Tour has its own different story. You know, Greg LeMond's comeback in 1989 is, you know, one of the greatest, because I predicted he couldn't do it. And Liggett actually said, we did this before the start of the stage. And Phil asked me the question, well, you know, who's going to win? I said, well, obviously, Fignon's going to win because he's got such a big advantage. It's a downhill time trial. 24 kilometers, there's no way you can pull back that amount of time. And Phil said, well, I believe Greg LeMond's going to win by 5 or 6 seconds. And that was on camera. So afterwards, I said to Leo, why do you say that? I said that was ridiculous. And he said, well, if I'd said that I agreed with you, everybody would have turned off and nobody would have watched.
Well, that's an interesting perspective, of course.
Well, as it turns out, he was absolutely right.
I know.
Well, for a couple of seconds, anyway. For a couple of seconds.
Yeah. I'm talking with Paul Sherwin. He is, as everybody who listens to any of the great cycling races, the voice of cycling, along with his sidekick, Phil Liggett. And I'm sure Phil would appreciate that. And he is speaking to us from his home in Uganda. When are you heading back over to the continent?
Well, I was just in the States for the Tour of California,
right?
Which I really enjoyed. It was a great race this year. It's a beautiful state and a great state to have a bike race in. I'm heading back in a couple of weeks. I'm going to England a week before the start of the Tour de France to take advantage of it starting in the United Kingdom to go and see some friends and family.
Oh, well, that's good. Well, I want to ask a little bit about some opinion. Since the days of Festina and all the other scandals, how do you keep such a positive perspective on cycling?
Well, I think, you know, there's two ways of looking at life. You can look at everything in a negative way, or look at things in a positive way.
True.
I like to think, and I mean, I've been caught out several times, as many, many people with the sport. But I like to think about, when I'm looking at the Tour de France, I'm not looking at a guy saying, you know, I wonder what anabolic steroid he had for breakfast, or I wonder if he did testosterone patches last week. I'm looking at the pictures. It's like I'm walking through an art gallery. I'm looking at the image that the race is going through, and I look at the beauty. Because if you stop that picture, forget about the rest. If you stop that picture and look at the peloton going through a field of poppies, going through a field of sunflowers, or going over a majestic mountain climb, that's the magic people always ask me about all the bad things that have happened in the sports, and you know why I don't get depressed about it, and why, you know, when cycling's taken so many knocks, why I keep a positive view. I always like to look on the bright side, almost a cue for a song, and look on the bright side of life, Monty Python. But it's, you know, when I look at a stage of the Tour de France, if you freeze the frame, more often than not, you can look at the image of the race going through a poppy field or going through the sunflower seeds or going over a mountain pass, and it's beautiful. It's like a painting. It's like walking through an art gallery, and that's what I'm trying to pass on, my interpretation of what I'm looking at, rather than thinking about the bad things. I mean, when you drive, if you want to try driving down the road in Kampala, if you think, you know, if you think the cycling's had a lot of bad knocks, it's blooming dangerous trying to cross the road in Kampala. Traffic, how bad it is.
Interesting. Interesting.
Well, I smile.
Yeah, but you smile. Exactly. Well, what are you going to do? Cry about it? Sure, I understand. Let's talk a little bit about this year's tour. Do you have any ideas about who we might be watching?
It's always hard. It's always hard. People always ask me a month, 6 weeks before the Tour de France, you know, who's going to do well. But right now, we're coming into what I always regard as the critical time to give the indicators as to who's going to be good. We're coming up to the Dauphiné. We're coming up to the Tour of Switzerland. Those are the two events that you look at to get an indication of who's on track. I think Chris Froome is. I'd really like Chris Froome to be back on track, because obviously there's a little bit of an African link there for me, because Chris Froome grew up in Nairobi, educated in South Africa. So I'm probably the only journalist on the Tour de France who can speak to him in a native language, which is Swahili, because he speaks Swahili as well as I do. So I'm hoping that he'll be able to come back and confirm that, you know, what he did last year.
Well, Wiggins did well in California.
Wiggins, I thought, rode very, very well in California. And what was more important than him riding well was he seemed to be happy. He seemed to be relaxed. And that, to me, is the important thing, because I think Wiggo, I never thought that Wiggins could win the Tour de France, but I think he pushed himself right to the limit physically and mentally to get through 2012, with the Olympics being in the UK and London in 2012. I think at the end of that year, I think he got, I don't mean he snapped, but I think he just decompressed is the word the French would use. He just let it all go, and he found it hard getting back into the motivation in 2013. This year he's changed his goals. He's thinking forward to the next Olympic Games. He's ridden Paris-Roubaix, which he enjoyed. He thought, wow, I'm in the top 10 here. Flipping heck. He's looking around and with, you know, Tom Boonen and Fabian Cancellara. And when I saw him at California, I thought, this is a Wiggins from 2 or 3 years ago. It's going to be tough, though, as to whether or not they'll put him in the team. And that's going to be the next. That's going to be the next bit of scandal that will come out of Team Sky. But I think they might have to put him in the team. You know, with the injuries they've had this year, I think it'll be a tough call to leave Wiggins out of the tour team.
The last thing I want to talk about is, do you have a favorite stage of the tour? Now, it's starting in a different place this year. It'll, of course, end as it always does, down the Champs-Élysées. But do you have a favorite stage of the Tour de France, one that you just love reporting on?
I always love Alpe d'Huez. I mean, if I have to, I mean, that came to my mind straight away, because I've got so many memories of riding Alpe d'Huez myself when I rode the Tour. I rode Alpe d'Huez. I mean, last year they rode the Alpe d'Huez on two occasions. I rode Alpe d'Huez when they had two stages finishing at Alpe d'Huez.
Hmm.
We finished up it one day, started at the bottom the next day and did a loop, and then came back up it. And then had a rest day the next day, and our team manager made us ride back up it. So Alpe d'Huez holds a little bit of a special place in my heart.
Yeah, not always 100% positive. It's like, really? We have to do this again?
Yeah, no, Alpe d'Huez is special. It's a great place. I mean, I think it's fantastic. It is an iconic climb. But so, you know, so too then is the Mont Ventoux. But I think, you know, off the top of my head, Alpe d'Huez comes up to me on top, which is amazing for me to say that as the best non-climber in the whole of the Tour de France's history.
Is that so?
I was pathetic. My nickname was Climber when I climbed, when I raced, because I was such a bad climber.
I want to ask you something personal, if you don't mind. And that is, you've done a lot of things that people don't know about. Everybody thinks of you as the voice of the Tour de France and other races, of course. But pick one of the things that you've done and just tell us a little bit about it. I know the one that that just blew me away, but I'll let you tell me which you prefer.
Yeah, well, I've been involved in a number of businesses and still involved in a number of businesses in Uganda. I think probably one of the things that's given me the greatest pleasure, apart from having been a safari guide, I love taking people on safari. I've never taken anybody to a safari in Kenya or Uganda who's gone away with a negative view of the African continent. And the more people you bring to Africa, the more people realize how amazing a place it is. And in fact, there's a guy called Ashish Thakkar who did a big presentation today. He's one of the youngest millionaires in Africa. And he said, forget about China, forget about India. The new place, the new development is Africa. And I think that is, people have forgotten about Africa. It's been regarded as the dark continent. Watch out for Africa over the next 10 years, because that's where there's going to be major development.
I think that's awesome. Well, I really, really appreciate you taking time to talk with me today.
Well,
Tell me.
Just finish off. One thing that
Absolutely.
I'm really, really proud of
okay.
is actually starting a small welding company in Kampala, which has certified 40 Ugandan welders up to international standards with Lloyd's of London Register and the American Petroleum Institute certification. And that has made me very proud, because people say, oh, you can't do this because Africa is so far behind. Well, we can, and we've done it. And that's why I believe in Africa, and that's why I believe Africa's got a great future ahead of it. And let's not forget, your colleague, Jonathan Boyer.
I was just going to mention him.
Yep. He's my neighbor. Well, he's about 10 hours away from here, and he has set up an unbelievable program for training cyclists in Rwanda. And I'd love to have the time and the power to do that in Uganda and in East Africa, what Jock has done just across the border. So watch out for the African cyclists. I mean, today was Colombia's day in the Giro d'Italia, but I think in the next few years, you'll see African cyclists coming to the fore as well.
Well, that's what Jacques and Kimberly say, and I have to believe them. They're doing very, very well, and we've spoken with them several times on the show. I've been watching the Rwandan teams, and now Kimberly, of course, is doing all this work with women cyclists.
I think the Tour of California Amgen did a great job in increasing the number of days to two days for the women's racing. The women were fantastic at the Amgen Tour of California. And I think women's cycling is on a rise all around the world, not just in the United States or in Australia or in Europe. It's coming up all around the globe, and it's great to see, and it's great to see the support.
I agree. Well, on that note, I'm going to let you get back to what you're doing. I know it's nighttime where you are. Thank you so much for talking with me. Have fun at the tour this year, and we'll talk again.
Thank you very much. It was a pleasure.
All right, Paul. Bye-bye.
Bye.
Paul Sherwin joined me from his home in Uganda, and as expected, what a wonderful human being, and he certainly has his interesting things to say about Mr. Phil Liggett. Paul Sherwin passed away on December 2, 2018 at his home in Uganda. His career spanned 33 years in our sport. If you'd like to hear a story that was told on the day after he passed, you can log on to npr.org and type in his name. So that's our show for this week. I hope you enjoyed both encore presentations. I'd like to remind you that The Outspoken Cyclist is a listener-supported podcast. If you like the show and think that it adds value to you and your cycling Jones, that craving you have to know more about the sport and all its idiosyncrasies, please consider donating to The Outspoken Cyclist. There's no minimum amount. Whatever you feel is comfortable is perfect for me. There's a little widget at www.outspokencyclist.com that allows you to choose an amount, and it will take you directly to PayPal, where you can use their portal or your credit card. Remember, you can always join our conversation on Facebook. You can leave us a tweet at Outspoken Cyclist without an E. Or you can leave a comment on our blog, OutspokenCyclist.com. Thanks for listening. I'll be back next week with a brand new show, including the first of a four-part series on common cycling injuries with Florida orthopedic specialist Dr. Jonathan Hirsch. I hope you have a great week. Stay safe. And remember, if you have a chance, go for a ride. Bye-bye.
Thanks for joining us today on The Outspoken Cyclist with Diane Jenks. We hope you enjoyed this week's show and welcome your comments and thoughts on Twitter and Facebook. Visit OutspokenCyclist.com to hear this and all past shows. We'll be back next week with more great conversation and news from the world of cycling. Remember, you can subscribe to our podcast on iTunes or Stitcher and never miss an episode. The Outspoken Cyclist is a copyrighted production of DBL Promotions with the assistance of WJCU-FM Cleveland, a service of John Carroll University. Thanks again for listening, ride safely, and we'll see you next week.